This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 3rd, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 368. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, November 5th is Election Day across the U.S. of A., the climax of the race for the White House. Will ex-President Donald Trump or Vice President Kamala Harris become the 47th president? It's not the only choice Americans are making. What else is on the ballot next door to BC in Washington State? My guest is Ron Judd, executive editor of the Cascadia Daily News in Bellingham, which covers Whatcom and Skagit counties and the San Juan Islands. And the final count of BC's election is over. David Eby's NDP won a 47-seat majority, but it's going to extra innings. A judicial recount is scheduled in Surrey, Guildford. So what's next? The MMA panel returns with Mario Canseco and Andy Yan. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. November 5th, our neighbors down south are going to the ballot boxes, unless they've gone already, unless they've cast their vote already, unless they put their vote in a mail drop box. There's local, state, and national elections across the United States. You've probably heard of the top of the ballot, the presidential election. I wanted to find out what's going on across the border in Washington State, so I contacted Cascadia Daily News executive editor Ron Judd. Cascadia Daily News is based in Bellingham, Washington, and it reports on the northwest corner of Washington State, Whatcom and Skagit counties, and the San Juan Islands, all beautiful places with friendly people. The Cascadia Daily News will celebrate its third anniversary next January, shortly after a new president is sworn in. Now, Ron is a former sports reporter and columnist with the Seattle Times. Met him, crossed paths with him a number of times when we were both covering the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. Now, Ron, the news out of Washington State this week hasn't really been at all about the issues and the policies of the candidates and who the candidates are. It's taken a bit of a backseat to some troubling incidents. There's been some arsons at ballot drop boxes, different from British Columbia, is that vote by mail really is the norm. And people just drive up or walk up and put their ballots into large drop boxes, which look like oversized mailboxes. What has happened there? And what is the general mood of voters and candidates that this is happening?
Well, it's nice to be with you, by the way, Bob. I think people are very stressed out here about the national election, and it's fraught with a lot of concern because in my lifetime, which is 60 years, I don't think we've ever seen an election here where there's as much fear or expectation of violence, sabotage, above and beyond what happened in the 2016 election and the 2020 election when Donald Trump still thinks that he won or claims that he won. And so there are a lot of people out to, there's a suspicion there's a lot of people out to create mayhem. And in Washington State, like you said, we have an all-mail election. Everybody votes by mail, same in Oregon. And one of the collection boxes, or two of them now, have been sort of hit with some incendiary device and some ballots were destroyed. And we've built a lot of things into our election system here to compensate for that, in that individual voters, that once you turn in your mail ballot, you can go to the website of your local county auditor or have a text message sent to you that acknowledges that they got it and they received it. And then if that doesn't come through, you can get a provisional ballot and revote. And these were a couple of very, so far, thank goodness, isolated incidents where people attacked these mailboxes. And we've done some reporting, or not mailboxes, but drop boxes. And they are a lot different than a mailbox in that they have a very defined small opening at the top that you can only fit like one or two ballots through. And then ones in our county actually have, I learned, a fire suppression device inside should somebody throw a match in there. These kind of things are things that auditors have already thought about. So that's a concern, and they haven't really figured out who did it yet. They have some leads in the case, and we don't know if this is a concerted campaign or just kind of a one-off thing for somebody that wanted to cause trouble. the big stressor is this is an election where, and as a newspaper editor, a lot of people get asking me, what do you think is going to happen next Tuesday? And I honestly say, I have no idea. The polls are so tight here. Nobody knows what's going to happen on Tuesday. And I think I'm sending our reporters out on Tuesday night on election night when results start coming in from the East Coast to just document what I think will be an incredible moment in the history of America. No matter what happens, either way, it's going to be a major turning point for this country. And it could go a couple extremely opposite directions depending on who wins this election, more so than I think has maybe been the case in our country a few times, like maybe during the Reconstruction era of the Civil War, things like that, way beyond the scale of what most living people can remember.
I had a small taste of what was to come back the morning after the 2016 election. I actually came down and watched the election results at the Bellingham Bay Brewing Company, enjoyed a few beers, and watched the results come in. The next morning at the hotel I was staying at the breakfast room, someone who was a Trump supporter and someone who was a Hillary Clinton supporter almost came to blows.
Wow.
The hotel staff had to come and keep them apart, and I knew, of course, that the rhetoric across the country was quite severe, and we saw what has happened in the years since on a national scale, a lot of ugly incidents and a lot of questions about American democracy and also questions about foreign interference, and we're seeing similar divisions here in Canada. What is the mood of the voters down in Bellingham and around the northwest corner of Washington State? Do you think that that the Democratic support, traditional support, is solid, or do you think that Trump's message could resonate with some voters there?
Yeah, in our state, I think that there's little doubt that Washington will go blue, which it usually does by a healthy margin. And that's like many other places in the country, that concentrations of population in the urban centers here in Seattle and Spokane and Bellingham and Bellevue and places like that, probably similar to BC, are vote heavily liberal to moderate liberal. The rural areas in our county even vote very heavily conservative or GOP, I guess. I don't really consider most of the leadership of the GOP to be truly conservatives anymore. They're on their own path. But that creates an interesting situation for us. And we have this sort of like disassociation here because this huge election is about to happen. It's going to dramatically impact all of our lives and the future of direction of the country. And we feel a little bit disconnected from it because of our odd electoral college system here. This election is really probably going to be determined in six or eight states. And we're not one of those. So we're looking at it afar. We're going to do our part and everybody's going to vote here. But we feel like it's not really going to have a direct influence on what happens on Tuesday. And I think that makes it a little bit even more unsettling that this is going to be decided by other people in our country who may or may not have a lot of things in common with us in our state, in our part of the country. I mean, a lot of people here probably feel like they have more in common with people in BC than in Oklahoma, because of just regional connections. And so that, in my mind, makes it even more stressful for people. And I do think that there is a lot of anxiety here. I feel like the people who are lifelong mainstream Democrats feel like that it's going to go their way, but it may be ugly. And even if it does go their way, there very likely could be a long, protracted period of disputes about the election. And that is a very realistic fear. I think that if the Trump people lose, they probably already have plans in place to create all sorts of mayhem that could draw this out for a very long time. And that creates a period of instability for the economy, for culture, for everything. And there's a lot of angst and reservation, I feel like, in the business community around here too, and in Washington State. I've heard from business people who say, we're not going to make any big investments in our logging business or our solar panel business or anything until we know what the political ground playing field is going to be after the election. And that's a serious, serious point in time, and it's going to be a tipping point one way or the other. But in a lot of ways, many things are on hold, I think, waiting for this electoral vote to come in. And it's the thing where it's a before the election and after the election thing that is dominating everybody's lives in a quiet way, I think.
Yeah, and if American businesses aren't going to invest or are going to sit in their wallets, that also affects international trade, cross-border trade. So that
Absolutely.
means that here in British Columbia, we can feel a bit of that pain temporarily until that stability returns. Is this going to go into the wee hours, or is this going to go into days and weeks before we know exactly who will be occupying the White House starting next January?
Honestly, I think it's a matter of days, probably before any sort of certainty, if it turns out to be as close as it's been advertised. I mean, if we see results start coming in from the east and south very early on with healthy margins for one candidate or the other, I think there's a likelihood that there could be some sort of at least provisional result the next day. But I don't expect that to happen. I don't think most people expect that to happen. And a lot of that is caused just by logistics. You know, there are more and more states like ours that do vote by mail. And so in Washington State, you don't have to have your ballot postmarked or dropped off at a drop box until 8 o'clock on election night. And those take, you know, a good probably 4 or 5 days usually to get mostly counted by machines. Sometimes there's a recount. You know, and if that happens in a key state, one of the key states that lead to victory for through the Electoral College for one candidate, that could take a very long time. And it provides a lot of time for people to dream up creative lawsuits and file other actions. And we don't know what's going to happen with Congress, depending on the status of who's running Congress is going to also be in the balance on Tuesday night. And who's going to, you know, we know who's running Congress now. So both parties have made plans. We've read to try to tamp down any effort to throw the whole election into the House of Representatives or something, which would be chaos. And that's the biggest concern. But I don't expect that there'll be a lot of clarity on the night of the election. I'd be shocked if that happened. It hasn't happened in any of the recent elections, mostly because they've been within a few points, and there is a lot of after the fact counting that still has to go on.
The governor, Jay Inslee, is retiring, and his Democrat successor, Democrat nominee, is Attorney General Bob Ferguson, going up against Dave Reichert, who we may have seen on the news more than a few times, the cross-border news, former congressman, but also former King County police chief. Reichert is for the Republicans, and Ferguson is for the Democrats. How do you think that race will go, and what are the big issues? I mean, you've got an attorney general, incumbent attorney general, you've got a former police chief.
Yeah, well, oddly enough, law and order is a thing that's emphasized by both candidates. Ferguson, with a 12-year record as an attorney general, is touting himself as a, you know, a protector of laws and legality, but he's not a law enforcement official. Reichert is a former county sheriff whose claim to fame was catching the Green River Killer, which I always noted took him 25 years. But Ferguson is a very, very, very active, aggressive consumer advocate. He's successfully filed lawsuits against the federal government, the Trump administration, but also the Biden administration and big companies in America, and joined in a lot of class action suits with like-minded attorney generals around the U.S. to enact laws and restore protections for consumers. And that has been his niche. He has, a lot of people say, been kind of quietly running for governor for those whole 12 years. And is a very sharp, responsive candidate who has made a big issue in this election, female productive rights and abortion laws, because of the loss of federal protection for abortions with the U.S. Supreme Court. Ferguson immediately moved to bolster sanctions that protect legal rights in Washington state, including the right of women in neighboring states, such as Idaho, to come here for health care, and ensure that those people are not prosecuted or tracked or messed with in any way. I believe in our state, it's a weakness for Reichert, who, because I don't think he's an extremist on the issue, but because of his time in Congress, often voted with some other extremists in things that, you know, go up to the edge of a national abortion ban. So that's going to hurt him here. I think Ferguson, because of that, is a heavy favorite in this race, just because of the numbers of people who will vote a Democratic ticket. And I think he's run a really effective campaign. Our newspaper endorsed him for the governor's race, and his opponent, Dave Reichert, did not sit with an interview for us, and, you know, so has run a different sort of campaign and has tried to distance himself a little bit from the Trump movement, and I think only marginally successfully. So I'd be very surprised if Ferguson doesn't win that race by a fairly healthy margin. Excuse me. And I think that He's different in a lot of ways from Jay Inslee. Inslee was the governor here for 12 years and sort of a monolithic political figure and very, very much environmentally focused, and was responsible for shepherding through the cap and trade law that you talked about earlier, which has been heavily criticized by a lot of people in rural areas, especially because it's credited with raising the price of gasoline here. And I know this won't draw any tears from BC, but it's raised our price of gasoline maybe 40, 50 cents a gallon because the big polluters in our state now have to, basically buy the right to pollute, and they've passed that along to consumers. And so that's a big issue. There's a state initiative, one of the ones that you mentioned, that's on the ballot right now to repeal that cap and basically what amounts to a cap and trade law. And a big number, almost unprecedented number, coalition of liberals and unions and public service people and firefighters have organized to try to kill that initiative to keep that funding in place, because its real impact has been to distribute money to a lot of rural areas, especially to institute green infrastructure and change, convert energy to more clean sources and fight wildfires, things like that. All these channels of funding have been established from the money that's taken from the refineries and other polluters to do good in communities. And it's created a lot of jobs. It's been very popular. And there's a wealthy Seattleite who has organized this initiative to overturn that, and also overturn a sort of fledgling capital gains tax that we have in Washington State, because we are constitutionally forbidden from having an income tax. We have a very regressive tax system here, where the lower middle classes pay a much heavier share than the upper classes because of the sales tax is our primary funding source. And so for this guy has organized a group of people to try to overturn four of what people feel are progressive measures to right the ship a bit in our tax structure and state revenue structure. And I haven't really seen a lot of polling that shows sentiment on those. It's always easy to pass an initiative that people think will save them money directly from their pocketbook. So I wouldn't be shocked if some or all of those initiatives passed. I think it'd be really bad public policy if they did. It would be going backwards, and a lot of progress has been made in the past decade here for important issues.
And also, people will be voting on natural gas, use of natural gas from a consumer standpoint.
Yeah, that's one of those four initiatives, and it's the most muddled one. And to be honest, it's the big conversation here is, in Bellingham, especially, in place where there's a lot of environmentalists, there's been a very strong push to convert everything to electric, put it on the electric grid as fast as possible, because it's greener power. A lot of our power comes from hydro, but I feel like there's a perception here that all of our power comes from hydro projects in Washington State, and this is not true. Like in Bellingham, our electrical provider here, Puget Sound Energy, still gets about 60% of its generation from carbon sources, from coal, which they're phasing out, but from natural gas plants and other places. And people are very concerned about, some people, especially in small towns, are concerned about protecting what they see as their right to have a choice in what they use to heat their own homes. And they're afraid that the state is going to push this electrification question ahead farther and more aggressively than they're comfortable with, meaning that people will have to make conversions at great cost of their home heating and their stove and their range in their kitchen. And there's really no movement at the state level to ban natural gas, but there's fear of that in the public. And the people behind the initiative have used that very effectively to say you should enact this initiative that would prevent the government, it would prevent the state government from banning natural gas, because, it's going to put the cost of this energy conversion otherwise on the backs of lower to middle income class folks. And that's a very persuasive argument. I don't know how that initiative is going to go, and I question how impactful it's going to be in either way, because I think it'll probably be challenged in court. It's one of those initiatives that does several things in one initiative, which according to our Constitution should not happen. And many of these initiatives have been passed in Washington State in the past. I'm sure you remember by Tim Iman, who was a sort of professional initiative huckster. He made his living by putting up these initiatives every year. Many of them got thrown out by the state Supreme Court for that very reason, because in spite of his 20 some years doing it, he never really figured out how to write an initiative that was safe from that challenge. So this one will probably be another one that goes to court. And I don't think it's as consequential in the short term as the other ones, which directly affect state funding. If two of these initiatives pass, one of which is the capital gains tax and the other one is the cap and trade thing, it's going to leave a multi-billion dollar hole in the state budget this year, compared to the last biennium. And that's going to mean cuts to some programs that are very popular.
And in total, how long is the ballot for voters down in Whatcom and Skagit counties? How long is the ballot? How many questions off the top of your head are people being asked on both candidates for
That's a good
positions
question.
as well
I don't
as?
have one in front of me at the moment, but it's actually shorter than usual this election. We have a lot fewer. We do really aggressive election coverage here at Cascadia Daily News, as we think it's one of our primary roles. And we're a for-profit company with a paywall, but we put all of our election news out for free, and we feel like it's been really highly read. But there aren't any really hotly contested races here, like the mayor, or last election we had the mayor of Bellingham, the sheriff in Whatcom County was a very interesting race. Some very testy council elections. This time, most of our elections are for state representatives to the legislature, and we have a number of incumbents here who are mostly progressives who are either not challenged at all or challenged by candidates who seem really not well prepared and have not run aggressive campaigns. So we don't see a lot of squeaky races happening there. We have some other local measures on the ballot, like city measures in Bellingham that are trotted out frequently for the election, but it's mostly state legislative races and the state initiatives that have drawn the most interest here. Excuse me. Interesting contest for state public lands commissioner is always very of great interest in our area because impacts on state trust lands of forests. And this sounds crazy to a lot of people outside of our area, but there's a direct connection between logging those state forest lands and construction of schools for K-12 education here. It's another thing in our constitution that's an anachronism, but it's there. And there's a long-running battle going on between people trying to preserve those stands of forest, which are some of they're not old growth, but they're the older growth, ones that have been logged once and are considered near old growth, almost old growth, kind of old growth. They're trying to protect those, and in many cases have been successful by going to the state and saying, this forest is unique, we should not cut this down. And the school district that sits next to that forest then is robbed of $300 million in funding to build their new schools. And so that's an interesting problem that pits people against each other in very unusual ways. That process is kind of guided and controlled by the Commissioner of Public Lands, and that job is up for grabs right now in a very close race between Dave Up the Grove, who's an environmentalist, and Jamie Herrera Butler, who is a former congresswoman from Southwest Washington. And if her name sounds familiar, she was one of the few people in the U.S. Congress who stood up to the Trump movement when they were trying to overthrow the election last time around. And so she's decided to push her career path towards a very different thing, and that makes for an interesting race.
And Dave Up the Grove, the Democrat, couldn't be a better name for a candidate for
Right.
state lands commissioner.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, on a lighter note, we started off, of course, with the heavy notes, but on a lighter note, what is something off the top of your head, an obscure measure, obscure ballot measure, something kind of off the wall in the ballot this time? Is there anything that strikes your fancy?
It's not obscure, but one of the least understood things that I've seen here at our paper is we have what's called in our county, Whatcom County, a charter commission that every 10 years elects public representatives to sit at a table and go, what do we need to do to change our laws and rules and standards in the county? And it could be about things, everything, major things, in fact, affecting like the size of the county commission. How many commissioners do we have? What districts do they represent? And it's a thing that happens so rarely that it's usually either activists or academics or somebody that runs for these positions. And fortunately, in the past, a lot of them have been people who know about politics and understand governmental structures, but some of them aren't and will come to this process with really crazy ideas about we should throw out the whole system and start over, or, just kind of off the wall stuff. And so we have, I think, a dozen candidates running for these seats, and none of them, we don't know a lot about most of them. We've tried to report who they are and what they do, but there's no active sort of like public forums where people are debating the issues for the Charter Commission. And so I think a lot of our voters, and I know I will, kind of look at those and scratch their head and go, I don't even know where to start here with this. They're not really clear on what the Charter Commission is. And even if they do, they don't really know who to vote for it unless they know something about one of the candidates. So it's frustrating. We try to step in as a media organization and shed some light on that, but it's difficult to get a lot of light on that process. And it's one of those weird pieces of American government or local government that is really important, but isn't really guided by the public's desires because they don't really understand the process. It's kind of lost its meaning in a way, but it's still there.
November 5th, you can stay up to date by going to CascadiaDaily.com. That's the newspaper based in Bellingham, Washington, Cascadia Daily News, executive editor, and my guest, Ron Judd. So thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thank you, Bob. And whatever happens, we'll try to keep the border open.
Excellent. Look forward to it. And keep the gas cheaper too. Time now for a mini version of the MMA panel with me, Mackin, the other M, Mario Canseco of Research Co., and the A, Andy Yan of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. On October 28th, Elections BC declared that the David Eby-led NDP had a 47-seat majority from the October 19th provincial election, the Conservatives under John Rustad 44 seats, and the Greens 2 under Sonia Furstenow. That, after the 27-vote squeaker in Surrey-Guildford in favor of the NDP's Gary Begg over the Conservative challenger Hanvir Randhawa, until then the NDP had a minority. So a judicial recount is scheduled for November 7th and 8th, so it could change again, but for now, the NDP has 50.53% of the 93 seats in the legislature after 44.87% of the popular vote, giving it 100% of the power. Mario and Andy, big question here, searching for a speaker. Do you think that he will remain with Raj Chauhan, the NDP MLA, as speaker since the 2020 election? Could he entice a Green, one of the two Greens, or maybe one of the Conservatives to fill the chair, just to give him some more breathing room when they call the legislature back when there is a new session in the new year? And Mario, go with you first.
I think they're trying to do that. It's going to be complicated because essentially you need to find somebody who's not particularly married to the conservative ideals. You know, somebody who won their seat but wasn't very close to Rostad, somebody who didn't, participate in the choir of voices that were complaining about specific issues. There's always somebody like that. You know, we all remember the David Emerson episode. You know, there's always going to be a possibility for somebody to, cross the floor if there's something more interesting on the other side. There's a way to do this, of course. Somebody could say, I'm disappointed with Rostad because he didn't do this or he didn't do that or he didn't disavow this candidate. That could be one of the options. I'd be very surprised if either of the two Greens decided to take this. You know, it's understandable for Darrell Plekas to do it because he had already spent a lot of time not as a speaker, and he thought it was a good opportunity to sort of head into the sunset. But it's still a complicated issue. I mean, even though they have one more seat now than they did on election night, you still have a government that could fall at any point. Yeah. And it's definitely not an easy situation, especially when you factor in the other issue. Ministers who lost their seats, ministers who retired, and a significantly young caucus on both sides of the aisle.
The NDP, and this is my list, the NDP will need new ministers of agriculture, education, environment, finance, forests, indigenous relations, labor, transportation, and land/water. That's because of both retirements and losses on election day. They do have some star candidates that they could possibly fill in those blanks with. Jody Wickens is returning from the Tri-Cities. Randine Neal, the former broadcaster. Tara Young, the former Vancouver Police senior officer. who won in Yaletown, and of course Christine Boyle in Little Mountain, the now, well, about to be former Vancouver City Councillor. So they do have some names, but they don't have the expertise that they had before, the whole crop of Horgan era loyalists.
I think you got to look at it almost in the same way that you would look at an American cabinet. Which areas voted for us and who can we promote to essentially say to those areas, we're with you. The fact that they did so well in Vancouver, winning every seat except Colchena, maybe a couple of those who were just elected will have a more prominent role. But you also had to extend an olive branch to Surrey. It's a place where they thought they were going to do better. If you want to appeal to that voter, you need to put one of them in charge of something big so that you can go back 4 years from now or 2 years from now, if this is an early one, and say, see, this is what happens when you send people from your community to our government.
I think in one way, you can count on, say, the deputy ministers, that perhaps the deputy ministers will kind of help step in and deal with the bridge. But yet, similarly, the experience, the public face, the calming of really what was a fairly, I think, segmented outcome for the election is going to be a challenge.
Christine Boyle is in Victoria now. She's leaving her seat at Main and 12th in Vancouver. It's going to be a $2 million by-election sometime in the new year. It'll be well over the midterm hump. It's 2026 or bust now. We can see our way towards the next civic election. Is there someone who might want to run for this seat who might want to be there to gain profile before a run for the mayoralty in 2026 for either party?
You know, I think there's a history lesson here from what happens when you win a by-election. And to me, that name is Hector Bremner. He wins the by-election. They start to get this crazy idea that he can be mayor. You start to put it in American terms, form an exploratory committee, and you start to believe all the hype yourself, and you surround yourself with political organizers who fill your heads with dreams, and you have columns where people say that you're going to win on the strength of the Filipino vote in the Fraser area, and you end up crashing and burning and not getting to double digits. So I wouldn't read too much into who wins the by-election as far as, you know, their possibilities of being candidates for mayor. I think it provides a unique opportunity for everybody. You know, ABC hasn't been great lately. We all were exposed to the type of language that they used in the chambers just a few days ago. My expectation was always that somebody who was elected as an ABC Park Board commissioner would take that role, you know, be rewarded for the fact that you stood with Ken Sim and everything is fine. And you know, maybe now you run for council and you can say, you see, I am somebody who loves the park board so much. I'm going to deal with the park board, but from my vantage point as a councillor. It's the first opportunity as well to essentially issue a statement on the way things have gone in Vancouver for the past couple of years. But I think it's more of a challenge from the left. Do you want to continue to have the wackiness that we had in 2022 when there's so many candidates of a center-left mindset that you don't know who to choose? You know, maybe you like a couple of visions and you like a couple of copes and you like a couple of forward Vancouvers. And sooner or later, you run out of room in your ballot because you want to vote for 17 people. I think they need to get together, even though this is a one city seat. I think the best course of action would be to talk to all of the other forces, including the Greens, and saying we need to replace Christine Boyle with somebody who's going to work with you two. So why don't we get together, choose a candidate, you support them, we support them, COPE supports them, the remnants of Forward Vancouver and Vision Vancouver support them. And away we go. I mean, ideally, you want to have this work almost like an American runoff. You know, there's one from the right, there's one from the left, left environmentally, if you want to add the Greens to it, and just may the best candidate win.
Should they also ask the citizens something else about spending, about policy? Right. A referendum question. What do you think the citizens should be asked on the ballot, not just about who's going to fill the empty seat on city council?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, are you, this is perhaps saying, should we have a referendum on the parks board? Like, would this be an opportunity to measure whether Vancouver wants a parks board or not in terms of direct democracy? I think that this would be a really interesting opportunity. But then at the same time, the long history of these types of elections, in between elections, by elections, civic by elections, are some of the worst participated types of elections, and how that may accidentally, I think, give the wrong sense of where people want the direction. I think, yeah, whoever wins, as Mario has identified, is susceptible to a horrible virus, and it's called the Dunning-Kruger virus. That. The Dunning-Kruger virus is vicious towards political careers, giving a sense of confidence and utterly demolishing what the outcomes are in the forthcoming election. That I think that this is one of these interesting times. I mean, for me, I think what would happen in a by-election is actually how it might be used as a referendum on ABC to really say that, hey, are we taking this to the right direction? If we are, then I think if ABC, say, would have won this by-election, although I can't imagine why they would spend the amount of resources it would, they would take it as a signal to many of their other policies in terms of getting rid of the Parks Board, looking at really other avenues that they're currently doing. But I think that all being said, I think that it is, I think, one of those things where the danger is actually reading too much, both on the outside, but then also from the inside.
And finally, we talked earlier about the NDP under David Eby achieving 47 seats in the provincial election. Mm-hmm. 47 is also a key number down south across the border, because mm-hmm. Donald Trump, the ex-president, number 45, wants to become the next president, which would be number 47. Start with you, Mario Canseco. What do you think will happen on November 5th in the presidential election between Harris and Trump?
I think it's going to be very difficult for Trump to overtake Harris in the popular vote. And election night is going to be close. I think we're going to go to bed with a popular vote somewhere in the vicinity of 48-49% for Harris, and 47-48% for Trump. But when you're factoring all of the California votes, because of the way in which they tally their ballots, so they are essentially projecting a winner, similar to the thing Mexico does, which is you take a little bit of each of the polling stations and you go, this is how we think it's going to happen, and the winner of this state is going to be Kamala Harris. But once you factor in those 15-17 million ballots, that pushes Kamala Harris probably closer to 51%. So I don't think the popular vote is going to be won by Trump. Now, obviously, what matters is the Electoral College. Our numbers have been very close in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. I think there's two states to watch, which are Arizona, where Kerry Lake has become extremely polarizing and unpopular, and that could draw the level of support for Trump down to maybe losing the state. And the other is North Carolina, where Mark Robinson has been on the news for all the wrong reasons. The Republican nominee for governor, browsing websites that are significantly questionable and offering some all sorts of assessments of how he feels about specific issues. When you have a gubernatorial candidate that is so unpopular, that could depress the turnout. So it's also one of the states where the Democrats could do a little bit better. And finally, I don't think we're going to know that night. Mm-hmm. Every state has different ways of counting ballots. We're not going to have as many mail-in ballots as we did in 2020. So that minimizes the chances of some of the battleground states not being called. But if we're within striking distance of that 270 electoral vote mark, and Arizona hasn't finished, and Georgia hasn't finished, and North Carolina hasn't finished, we might have to wait until probably Thursday or Friday before we can finally say, this is the 47th president of the United States.
I hope we get a clear and decisive answer, and then we might not. And I think that this, I think, is an ongoing kind of challenge in the United States, talking about the kind of division. And mind you, at the same time, we've kind of experienced our own kind of counting issues here in British Columbia. And we did some sizable investments in the way we tally our votes. But yet in the United States, they have varying states, have varying counties with different ways of counting, for which take time to collect. And I think that this is really going to be one of the kind of big questions moving on. I mean, hopefully this is not the beginning of the final season of America, but that really is going to be, I think, an important election. But yet how it will end, I think, is still up in the air because of just really the amount of not only about the kind of division amongst the kind of electoral options, but then the structural, I think, diversity that's in here in terms of how people vote, where people vote, who gets to vote, that I think adds a huge X factor towards what's going to happen in November 6th.
That was the MMA panel with me, Mackin, the other M, Mario Canseco of Research Co., and the A, Andy Yan of the City Program at Simon Fraser University.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, New Jersey legislature passes two pro-Taiwan resolutions. Resolutions praise growing Taiwan-New Jersey ties. Lawmakers passed resolutions to commemorate the 45th anniversary of the U.S.-Taiwan Relations Act and the 35th anniversary of the sister state relationship between Taiwan and New Jersey. The resolutions also supported the U.S. government's continued assistance in Taiwan's participation in the World Health Organization, International Civil Aviation Organization, and Interpol. In Kyoto news, Japan Prime Minister Ishiba arranging first summit with China's Xi in November. The PM is expected to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum Summit from November 15th to 16th in Peru, and the group of 20 leaders meeting from November 18th to 19th in Brazil. The bilateral summit will most likely take place in Peru, the source said. Ishiba will likely express concern over China's growing military activity around Japan, including its first breach of Japanese airspace in August. He will also aim to promote ministerial-level economic dialogue. In ABC News Australia, false alarm as thousands of Queenslanders receive texts warning of non-existent natural disasters. A council is investigating after its emergency warning system incorrectly alerted thousands of residents to fictional flooding and earthquake events early October 31st. A resident whose home flooded last year says he has little trust in the warning system. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, officials say they're prepared for post-election civil unrest. More than 100 Oregon leaders, including Governor Tina Kotek, have signed a letter calling for peaceful civic engagement in Portland during and after the election. Portland's Unified Command, a body that includes the Portland Police Bureau, Portland Emergency Management, and Portland Fire and Rescue, is working with partners in Multnomah County and neighboring cities to ensure public safety. In CascadiaDaily.com, Washington campaign finance numbers as 2024 election nears. Attorney General Bob Ferguson has outraised his Republican opponent and former King County Sheriff Dave Reichert nearly 2-1. Ferguson has brought in $13.5 million, while Reichert has $6.6 million in the race to become Washington's governor. Ferguson has spent $12.8 million to Reichert's $5.4 million. A majority of both candidates' contributions have come from small donations or party donations. And in the Breaker.News, read the stories behind these headlines. Elections BC allowed staff to take ballots home during advanced voting week, and North Van's 2023 Halloween fireworks map a hint of 2024's hotspots. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Come visit me there, too. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all of you who voted in the British Columbia election. More than 2 million of you. 2024 is the world's year of elections. Half the world's population has voted or will vote. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 3rd, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 3rd of November in 1992, the Democrat governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, defeated Republican President George Bush and independent Ross Perot in the U.S. presidential election? And some of us in Vancouver saw live coverage during U2's Zoo TV concert at BC Place Stadium. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.